Okay. Legal holiday learning for July 4th of 2022. Tafshin Ayin Beis, July 4th, Independence Day. We always, obviously, not necessarily written in the Torah, but Hakaras HaTov is talked about in the Torah. So when it comes to living in America, living in a place with such rich religious freedom, which we can never take for granted, you know, it doesn't take too many Tisha B'Av to realize the times in our history we haven't had that. So we always have to appreciate the country that we live in. We thank Hashem, we daven for the country that we live in, for the religious freedoms that we enjoy. But it wasn't always so easy, not because of what the country did, but because of what we did. And as we've talked about in the past, we've had, especially in the early 19th century, mid-19th century, we've had issues of the Jewish people keeping halacha properly. And this is no different, the example that we'll talk about today. First of all, thank you to Milt Newman for sponsoring, refreshment sponsoring this year. Le'ilei Nishmas, Leia, Sara, Bas, I always forget the four, Chaya, Sara, Shana, Chasha. Either way, so her neshama shehav Aliyah, a tremendously inspiring girl, but tragic early end to her life. So we daven for her, and we daven for the family, and we mirz Hashem through our learning and through Milt's tzedakah, her neshama shehav Aliyah. Today we're talking about an interesting letter. Now I will admit it's getting increasingly difficult to find, tshuvas from the early 19th century. There aren't that many. This is probably, what, our tenth class or so, last 3 years. Yeah, they didn't document everything. Maybe their typewriters were a little broken. I don't know. But it's not... Yeah, we're going to have to go into the 20th century soon. But for now, we still have an interesting letter. So we've talked about Rabbi Bernard Illui or Illui, before, maybe not recently though, we've talked about him in the past. He was a student of none other than Chassam Sofer. I have a little bit of a biography here for those who have the sheets. Rabbi Bernard Illui, PhD, I think we're going to talk about it, was born in Kolin, Bohemia in the year 1814, and he came of a family distinguished for its Talmudic learning and its piety. Illui received his early education in Mishnah and Talmud from his father. His father was also a Rav, who had destined him to be a teacher in Israel. I don't know if he literally means in Israel here. This is a more secular biography. So in Israel, probably here means as part of the Jewish people. He wanted him to be a rabbi. Almost from his birth, he completed his theological studies in the famous rabbinical school of Rabbi Moshe Sofer, the Chassam Sofer, Pressburg, Hungary, from whom he received the Hataras Torah, presumably that means Smicha, and received his degree of Doctor of Philosophy from the University of Budapest, Hungary. He studied Hebrew and exegesis in the rabbinical school of Padua, Italy, which itself was a formidable Jewish place. About the year 1845, he married Catherine. Interesting, he's marrying in Europe a girl named Catherine, the daughter of Wolf Schiff, a prominent merchant.
I wonder, though.
That's most likely true. His name, I think, was Yitzchak. Yeah, it's possible. He was called to Kassel in Germany to candidate for the position of chief rabbi, Landsrabiner, I don't know if that's how you say it or not, of the Principality of Hessen. The congregation of the whole electorate unanimously favored his selection. Everybody wanted him to be the rabbi. A man of most reactionary tendency, but then the minister of the interior, Hassan Flug, named Hassan Flush, I have no idea, a man of most reactionary tendencies, whose whole aim was a reestablishment of medieval Germany, bless you, refused to sanction his election because of his involvement in the revolution aforementioned, which I skipped over. There was a time where he had some kind of seal of the revolution, revolutionaries of the Bohemian Empire or something, that they assumed he might have been part of the revolution, and therefore they wouldn't let him get a job. This Rabbi Illui despite being unanimously selected by the shul, was denied the job. And therefore, he realized that he wasn't going to make it over there. He then came to this country, the United States, and filled the position of rabbi in New York City in congregation Shaarei Tzedek. In Philadelphia, in congregation Rodes Shalom in St. Louis, the United Hebrew congregation in Syracuse, in the congregation of Knesset Shalom in Baltimore, in the Stat Shul, the Lloyd Street Synagogue, in New Orleans, in congregation Shangarai Chesed, which is the same as Shaarei Chesed, but they just pronounced the I in that way when they transliterated it, and in Cincinnati, in the congregation Sheiris Yisrael. A lot of places. So we've talked about this in the past. So first of all, it was the case that in Europe, you oftentimes, if those who are familiar with their Legends and Lessons class, which we'll have tonight, I don't know who I'm talking about yet, unfortunately, they oftentimes would move around in Europe. They move around fairly often, either financial reasons or because, you know, just they exhausted their, you know, their authority, you know, people weren't listening to them anymore, or maybe they got too big for the position and they could move up in the world. You know, in Europe, there was a big distinction between communities. You had your little shtetls and you had your bigger cities and your big cities. So you would have sort of a progression, upward mobility in the rabbinate in Europe. In America, it was a little bit different. In America, you had a couple cities that were bigger, but all in all, they're all, you know, smaller towns. And the issue here more often was a lack of religiosity and lack of interest in a rabbi who was giving them the real thing. You know, these people would, as we'll see, as we've spoken about, they would rail against the rabbi for being too machmir about things. And especially given the fact that in America in the mid 19th century was really the first beginnings of the reform movement. A lot of these smaller towns had, if not a substantial reform presence, were starting to have a gradual growth of the reform presence in the communities, as we've seen before. We've talked about Charleston, South Carolina before, and then obviously Cincinnati, which is sort of the headquarters with Rev Isaac Mayer Wise. Ultimately, oh, I don't know. Right. He's going to bigger places. Yeah. I'm not sure. I can't tell you for each exact example, but I know that for sure was part of the issue. He had the distinction of being in his day, in his country, the only rabbi. This is from JewishHistory.com. The only rabbi with a thorough Talmudic education and a university training to stand for the cause of orthodoxy. Now, there are a couple conditions there, Talmudic training and university training. Maybe there were some with one and not the other. But either way, what is interesting is to note that there were people that were called rabbi before Rabbi Bernard Illouis in America. There were. We've talked about that with last year, July 4th. We talked about a man who we called Rabbi Chaim Solomon, who was very much involved in the financing of a lot of the American Revolution. Not a lot of, but responsible for sort of the money moving hands through him. If you remember, we talked about that statue that they have in Chicago. I think it's of him and Jefferson. I don't remember exactly for sure, but you can look back. First of all, you can look at the statue. Someone recently said, because that class was featured on YU Torah's July 4th classes. So somebody listened to it who actually works in the Chicago Jewish Historical Society and reached out to me with all this material about the statue, which I appreciate. So anyways, there's a lot of background into Chaim Solomon, but he wasn't really a trained rabbi. We call him rabbi because he has taken a leadership position, and many, many other prominent Jews had taken leadership positions, either as cantor or as laner or as davener or whatever, and you called them rabbi. But they didn't have not nearly the level of training as Rabbi Illouis did, and some certainly in Sheretz Israel in New York City, that was an established role all the way from the 17th century, the Spanish Portuguese synagogue. So they definitely had rabbis. Remember Rabbi Moshe Sextus that we've talked about before? Yes. He wasn't in America. In this country means America. Yeah. No. Europe was full of rabbis. This is the golden age of rabbis in Europe. Yeah. Also at university, plenty of other rabbis had. Yeah, plenty of other rabbis had, especially in Italy. I think in Italy, at some point, you needed to have a co-rec. But either way, what I love about this picture, this is an actual portrait of Rabbi Illouis. Anyone remember what we pointed out of this picture last time we did? Probably 2.5 years ago? Nope. Look even closer at his hands. He's wearing a ring. He's wearing a ring on his right hand ring finger. A signet of the revolution? No, that wasn't a ring. That was just something. He had like a stamp on his letter or something. This is a ring, right? There's a big discussion about whether or not you can wear rings as a man, as a begadisha, etc. But he's the student of the Chassam Sofer, and he was wearing a ring, right? The Chassam Sofer doesn't have to defend everything all of his students do. But the point is that he was learned from the Chassam Sofer. You can see he's a very put together guy. He's not one of these schlemazels from Europe that comes over with nothing to his name. He was a respectable and very proper person. So he's going to be talking about gas. So when I first saw this letter, I thought to myself, what is the history of gas in America? Because it's not necessarily the case that they always had gas. Of course it's not the case. And the question is, how does the timing shake out? And what we'll see in the tshuva is that it was somewhat of a fairly new innovation, the gas. And I was thinking, what kind of gas was it? I was talking to David Barth last week, who's upset he can't come, but he's in Chicago. And and David was telling me most likely it was coal-powered electricity, meaning like you would have on a ship or on a train, you'd put a bunch of coal and you'd burn it off, and that gas you could funnel it into some kind of piping system, and then through that piping you can light that gas on fire. Now, obviously, the most important thing that they would use that for was streetlights, first and foremost, and then ultimately got into homes. They'd have to make all those channels. They'd have to make all those pipes, right? They didn't have those pipes before. So you can see here, by the early 1830s, mining companies had emerged along Ohio, Illinois, and Mississippi rivers, and in the Appalachian region. As in European cities, the introduction of the steam locomotive gave the American coal industry a tremendous impetus. This, by the way, doesn't just mean for the sake of running the train, it also means for the sake of creating the train, because the Industrial Revolution wasn't just about having electricity or having power, but it was also about creation of items. And when you could have machinery that could make the items, it's a lot easier than people trying to make the items. So the coal-powered the power from coal wasn't just in order to illuminate, that's what we're going to be talking about, but it was more in terms of creating items through machinery. Which was a big deal, especially when you're talking about huge trains. It's not easy to bend the metal like you want it to go. So that's what it means here. Continuing expansion of industrial activity in the United States and Europe further promoted the use of coal. Interestingly enough, coal became second fiddle within a couple decades to natural gas, which you can mine straight from the ground. You wouldn't have to burn it in the same way. So I think you still do burn it to get some of the chemicals out, whatever. And sometimes you have to refine it from whatever liquid or material that it's sort of squeezed into, but it's a very different process. So natural gas basically takes over for coal as the main driver of gas-powered electricity. But the truth is that b'mchilas kvod David Barth, who definitely knows his stuff. So I looked into the history of natural gas. Rabbi Lowy doesn't talk about what he's referring to. Maybe doesn't even know it, the differences that specifically. But if you look at the brief history of natural gas, from the American Public Gas Association, I'm not going to judge a book by its cover, that seems pretty legitimate. The American Public Gas Association sounds like they would know something about the history of gas. They say this, the first commercialized natural gas occurred in Britain. Around 1785, the British used natural gas produced from coal to light houses and streets. In 1816, Baltimore, Maryland, used this type of manufactured natural gas to become the first city in the United States to light its streets with gas. So it could very well be that when Rabbi Bernard Illouy is talking about the Jewish residents of Baltimore, Maryland in 1863, he's talking about really the people on the cusp, the first ones who had had the option, the opportunity to use this new innovation. Now, obviously, the year 1816 is pretty early relative to what we're talking about, but it did take a while for that to get into homes, to get into other places. Yeah.
I was also wondering whether 1863 was obviously the middle of the Civil War. I was also wondering whether perhaps there was difficulty getting olive oil
1863 is, right. 1863 is definitely during wartime. I'm not sure about the context of the difficulty of resources, but what I do know is that coal, in response to the Civil War, became more and more necessary for the creation of ammunition. And I did read the history is basically that because of the Civil War, they created a lot more of these piping industries for the sake of using the coal for other things, like creating ammunition. So it could be that while, you know, one day did one, they did the other, and therefore is a sort of a, they all came at the same time. Yeah, Jason?
Is it possible that you could also be talking about whale oil?
Whale oil?
Yeah. Yes,
they burnt whale oil for extremely clean. So what would you use it for? How would you use it? You would have to get the whale,
yeah, well,
and then you would put it into some kind of plant, and then put it through the... You'd ship the whale oil?
Oil, yeah. The whale, you know,
yeah.
That's one of the reasons you used to kill whales,
interesting.
Is for the oil.
I'm not sure of the history of it. Sounds interesting.
But when it says gas power, it's not just an alternative to olive oil.
Are you talking about oil that produces gas? Are you talking about the oil itself that makes the fire?
Oil itself.
Okay. So Rabbi, right, I get it. That makes sense. But Rabbi Eloise says explicitly in the tshuva, he says the word gas, as we'll see in a second. So this is the history, the backdrop of the coal-powered gas and natural gas that comes in the sort of the context of this tshuva. So here you have, this is written in the Occident, volume 22, 1864. If you remember, the Occident was that publication that used to go around supposedly representing Orthodox Judaism. Although, as you can imagine, it gets a little dicey at times. Put together by Rabbi Isaac Lesser, spelled Leser. But you'll notice that this is 1864, 1865, and Rabbi Eloise is responding to something which happens in 1863. So I looked up this tshuva inside the Occident itself because I got it from Rabbi Eloise Sefer, where he compiles all his tshuvas, or his son compiled all his tshuvas. So I looked it up, you know, in the actual Occident, and there's a postscript to the Occident where it basically says, we apologize for the delay. We have to transcribe everything into Hebrew, and the Hebrew typeface is much harder, or whatever. It's like this whole publishing note, and it says in there, like, it's very interesting, for those that are interested in this kind of thing, it says in that paragraph, you know, a request to all people, if you're going to write us in Hebrew, please use block letters. It's much easier for us to transfer into the paper. Just like an interesting, like, thing you never think of today. But like, yeah, it depends how you got the material to transfer it over. Yeah, exactly. Stuff like that, yeah. Send it as a Word document, yeah. Either way, so they had to transcribe this into the Occident, so it's a little bit late in coming. But even Rabbi Eloi was a few months later. He writes this, I believe, if I remember correctly, in the beginning of Shvat. I think it was Parshas Tetzaveh that he wrote it. He has a sign-off, and I didn't put it here, but it says over there that he wrote it a few months after Hanukkah. But he's responding to what the Jewish people did in December of 1863. He's writing the tshuva in March of 64, and it's only printed later in 65.
But, or if he was somewhere else, and by the time
so
he
happened.
Got the
yeah,
tip,
yeah.
The question.
No, he wasn't in Baltimore at this point. He had been in Baltimore, but this is post his Baltimore stint. I believe he's in New Orleans. That's how he signs it off. He signs off New Orleans, but he's writing to a Rabbi Yehuda Rosenfeld. It would seem that it's supposed to be Rosenfeld. Although if you read it literally, it could be Rosefeld. I'm not really sure. We have talked about a Rosenfeld before, if anyone remembers. A couple years ago, we talked about a Rosenfeld who was hired in Cincinnati for a frum at the time, a frum shul, and he was loved by almost everybody. If you remember, there were like 180 members of the shul. They all loved him except for 14. 14 of them wrote a petition against him because a couple things. One is he had eaten this thing called a Muscovy duck. A Muscovy duck, which in Cincinnati they did not have a tradition of eating. But his response was, in Charleston we have the Masorah of eating this Muscovy duck. Right? So that we talked about the tradition of Muscovy duck. I think it was a Thanksgiving cheer. We talked about turkey also, which is sort of in the same boat. They also accused him of being on a train on Rosh Hashanah. on the second day of Rosh Hashanah, and he explained that he was stuck on the train, and the train had been rerouted and whatever. He couldn't do anything about it, but he was just passively on the train. He wasn't doing anything. So basically, he won the court of public opinion, but because of all of the hullabaloo, and because the Occident had published the accusations before confirming all the facts, and the shul writes back to the Occident, how could you do such a thing without knowing what's really happened? So there was such drama about it, so Rabbi Rosenfeld had resigned from the position, even though everyone loved him, and he moved to Savannah, Georgia. So we have heard from a Rabbi J. Rosenfeld before. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, from my research, this has got to be a different person. I can't find anywhere a Rabbi Judah Rosenfeld, or even Rosenfeld, but that was Rabbi Jacob Rosenfeld, at least according to documents. And therefore, this is probably a different person, despite the fact that Rabbi Eloi made it his point to know all the rabbis. Even Rabbi Weiss and Rabbi Lilienthal, who were themselves sort of promoting the Reform Judaism in Cincinnati, he made it his prerogative to know all the rabbis and try to create as much orthodoxy in America as possible. He tried to commence this, you know, conference of rabbis in Cleveland, but then he realized it was being co-opted by the Reform, and then he just didn't go. But he was trying to coalesce the Orthodox rabbis to create a precursor of the Orthodox Union, of Union of Orthodox Rabbis, whatever they originally were called. He was unsuccessful in doing that, but nonetheless, he kept in touch with all these different rabbis. I mean, especially through the Occident, they would talk to each other. So here's... Oh, maybe. Very much less yeshivish. Yeah, much less yeshivish. It's very. I find it fascinating reading through the Act, and it's publicly available online. You can just reading through, and it documents the most menial activities, like, oh, this shul put on an event in South Carolina and it talks about the minutes of people's board meetings, like. Things you would never think are important but are fascinating to look back on. And this person said this, and that person responded this, and they're trying to decide whether or not they should, you know, switch over to gas-powered lighting or whatever. So it talks, it's just fascinating, the development of shuls. It's not necessarily halachic, so I don't want to talk about it, but it's still fascinating to get sort of the background. If anyone wants to look through it, I can send you some links to it. So here's his response to Rabbi Rosenfeld in Baltimore. Right, so you can see the title here. Tshuva laharav Yehuda Rosenfeld al sheilato im mutar liyishtamish be'or hakitor hanikra gas l'ner Hanukkah. Right, it's called gas. Right, it's funny the way he says it. By the way, I did find a Rosenfeld in Baltimore, but it was a woman, and she was part of the Sisterhood's knitting club. So I know there was a Rosenfeld. I don't know if it's related, if he's related or not. But the times matched up. I thought it was cute that maybe it's to imagine, you know, the drama. That she's going to knit, and he's going to figure out whether or not you can light your Hanukkah like this. Just funny to imagine the drama. Okay. The Ezras Kel Emunasi Asim Shuvas Yiluish Me'alaf Masasi. I will put my response to this 1 in 1,000 man. The Osa Noem Karasi. It's hard sometimes these letters. You can't really read them. But Noem Karasi Hu Harav Hagon Yedidi V'Chavisi V'Chavivi Ke'achli. Right, my beloved, like a brother. Hamufla b'tor v'chachmo b'yira, I don't know what this acronym is, but Yehuda Rosenfeld v'kil kadosh Baltimore. You see this interesting ayin at the end there. Usually the ayin is when you have a functional e, like if you have New Rochelle, so you'll have an ayin lamed, something like that. But here it's Baltimore, because it used to be that you would transliterate every single letter, and they just replaced the e with an ayin. So I don't think this is later on. I don't think this is how you spelled Baltimore, and I don't think this is how you would spell it in Gittin nowadays. But that's how they just sort of assumed you just replace every letter. Right? So you can see the B. Interesting. They don't have an aleph there. There presumably should be an aleph there. B L T I M O R E. Right? Besides the A, they're pretty good. Right? They're just replacing letter for letter. Okay, so he's so that's the necessary accolades before the prescript. Ahuvi yedidi et mechtavcha hayakar kibati v'samti iuni al davar shelatcha for your letter, your beloved letter, your precious letter I got, and I looked into it, about your question. It's a good question, and in itself is half an answer. I'm not really sure what he means, but oftentimes when they would write the answer, when they would write the questions, they would have within there, you know, their proposed answers. So maybe that's what he means, you give half an answer yourself. Lo echarti, lo avarti amitzvatcha, v'gam lo shibachti, mehashiv lach, miyad ulahagi lach, ki yashir asav lo alvlasa bach. I didn't waste any time trying to get back to you. By the way, he's writing this 3 months later. So, meaning he got the letter, presumably a little after Hanukkah, and he only got it a few months later. Nowadays, you know, you get it in a few days, assuming the post office isn't messing your stuff up. But he's saying, I'm writing this as soon as I can. I'm writing back to you as soon as I can, which is pretty common in Cuba. You know, they either apologize for writing late, or they say, I wrote this right away. They just tell you when they wrote it in distinction to when you got the letter. Right, maybe the middle of the war also.
Probably quite a long time for mail to get from Baltimore to New Orleans.
Right, he's in New Orleans for sure. So it definitely could be. V'lo avlasa bach. So he says, v'mashlo hiskamta im ela. And you didn't do anything wrong by not agreeing with these people. What people? Asher asu menora l'ner chanaka bebeis ha-knesset. This is presumably because the first place that would get the gas would be the public institutions. First was the streets, then you'd have any schoolhouses, and then you have religious institutions. So meaning that they're lighting the menorah in the shul through gas, right? The shuls were first to get gas. They, I guess, you know, first on the list to get the pipes associated with them, to get them to tunnel through the ground or whatever to get to the shul, before you get to every house, which came, you know, pretty soon afterwards. That in the shul, lahadlika alidei ha'avir. Interesting way he says, what's avir? It's like air. Usually it's atmosphere or the sky or whatever. So here the avir means the air, the gas, hamitz ba'er, which can burn. Asher yale ba derach tzinorim. Had they known about gas burning before this, like air, that air, combustible air? Contained. Right. Right. I think they had known, especially in other places of the world, they had known that you could create fire out of the ground, because there was gases that could come out of the ground and be lit on fire. But here, to contain it and to control it in this way through the piping system maybe was an innovative thing.
Well, I think Priestley discovered that oxygen could burn in the 1700s.
Right. Okay. So then they knew about it already from the generation before, but to contain it in this way.
To be able to contain it.
Right. So listen how he explains the process. Asher yale baderach tzinorim mitachas la'aretz. It comes through these pipes that are under the ground. Asher bam ne'esu ha'avir. There they collect the gas. V'kochos hanovim v'nitfim miminim shonim. And I'm not exactly sure what those words mean. But they come from, and the power that comes from, and I don't know what nitfim means, but it's maybe processed from different types of materials. He doesn't say coal there, so I'm not sure what he means. The nose... What, nitfis? I don't know, it could be. Dafas means to print. I don't know if it's connected to that. Miminim shonim v'notnim or lema'or. And it brings light to light, to enlighten. V'rak yav or aleim. I hope people got my pun on the top of the page. The wrong kind of enlightenment.
No.
Okay. I thought that was good. But either way, so here v'nosnim or lama'or, they give light to enlighten. V'raki yavor aleihem esh, in order to create fire. V'hayu leva'er, for the sake of burning. V'nikra belaz, and in our country that's called gas. Ki ein shum. By the way, Rabbi Bernard Lowy spoke like 7 languages. So when you see the English in here, he probably did that himself. Right? This wasn't some kind of editorial correction. Ki ein shum safek v'einai ki yesh iser b'davar. Iser b'davar. It's usser to light the light. I know what Leonard's going to say. Why would it be usser to light it? Maybe you're just not doing the mitzvah. Right? That's it.
Especially since the mitzvah in a shul is different than the mitzvah.
Okay, good. I actually thought about this. He never addresses that, but I thought that.
In the shul, the whole purpose is pursuing mitzvah.
Good. Mikamatamim, so keep that in mind. Va'osim kein mevatlin mitzvah Chanukah legamrei. They have nullified the mitzvah entirely. So that's weird. If you're nullifying the mitzvah, so why is it usher? It's just you're just nullifying the mitzvah. So what's the usher?
Maybe making a bracha.
There it is. I knew Len was going to say it. Making a bracha levatel is usher. So let's look into the shuva. The truth is, he makes what he lists as 3 points. Point number one and point number two sound the same to me. So we're just going to, these are snippets from the shuva. It's about 3 or 4 pages long. So I just brought out some of the the standout arguments here. All good. Yeah, he talks about that a little bit. Yeah, and we'll see why. Right in the first paragraph, says Rabbi Elohi, ki ikar hanes hayapach hashemen. When we think about Hanukkah, what's the main miracle? What about it? So we have the war, and then we have the finding of the oil, and then we have the oil lasting. So says Rabbi Lowy, which one of these are we celebrating? So he says, Ikar Hanes Hayapach HaShemen. Pach HaShemen, meaning the literal oil jug, is what we're celebrating. Shematsu, V'lo Ha'or. The main aspect of the miracle, which is a bit of a chiddush, but the main aspect of the miracle is not the light. And he's going to prove it. V'lochein kasu kol poskim shemitzvah min amukra lahalik v'shemen zayis, ki HaShemen shehi likvim mikdash nasubonez hayashemen zayis. They said that the original was olive oil, and therefore the main way to do it is with olive oil. Ubdieved gam b'shava kasher, even though technically it wasn't what they originally used, at least the same material, you can still use shava. What's shava?
Wax.
Some wax or another. Why? Because with the wax, ki shava gam kein shemenhi, the wax is itself a form of oil. And that's what the rabbis listed in the Mishnah by Memavlikin. Masha eino min hashmanim halalu eino min hahechsher. And that which is not listed in there is not one of the allowed types of oil. Or fuels, I should say. Okay, yeah, I mean, but where does he know that it has to have a substance to it? From this Mishnah, which lists only things that are substantive. But yeah, you're right. But again, the Mishnah doesn't know about gas. Right? Yeah, yeah. And he points that out later on. Yeah. He points it out later on. He says, and even if you're going to tell me, I don't think I listed this, but even if you're going to tell me that they didn't know about it, but if they would have known about it, maybe they would have allowed it, it's not true. Because they knew about other types of things that could light on fire, but they didn't include them. Right? He says something like fruit juices of one kind or another that you could light on fire. I'm not familiar, but he said they did, back then they knew of other types of things that could light on fire, and they didn't list those. They wanted specifically things that came from oil, as some kind of oil connected to them. The had the Pali Big Gemara im hapsil sal ushman shamar chachamim ein malikim mehem b'shabbos ksherim heim lechanuka. Even though they make distinctions between Shabbos and Chanukah lights that you could use potentially, hainu davka hapsil sal shamar shamanu chachamim mishnah. Those are only ones listed in the Mishnah. Aval davar she'enu min hashemen. Anything that doesn't come from some kind of oil, lace, man, dekar, shmei, you shouldn't even mention it. Ubevadai, it's not mentioned. Ubevadai, lekulei alma asra, filu im oro tzachu bahir kizohar hakochavim. Even if it produces the most beautiful light, it's not the point. Kilo laora hutzarech, rak amis Hashem and anumavarsim. A big chiddush from Rabbi Elohi. We're not using Hanukkah candles for the sake of the light. We're using it. Okay, we'll come back to that at the end. We'll see whether that's relevant. But rather, it's because we're trying to memorialize the oil that was there. And even the candles have some oil in it, and that's why it's justifiable. But it's not ideal. Umitaretz. What? So, yeah, but it just skips to the next one. That's a previous paragraph. And then he brings a brisa. He brings a brisa, which is brought down in, I don't think it's actually in the Gemara. But it says there, the Braitha asks, why do they light for 8 days? Why do we light the candles for 8 days? And it says there, because it took them, this is a different Braitha, not the one you quote in day school, but they dealt with the making of the Mizbeach again for 8 days. That's how long it took them. The Tosef Lahakshos, and the Braitha continues, why do they light the candles? Perush halo ha-hadlak halo ha-isamin ha-nes. Meaning the Braitha itself asks, why do we light candles? What do you mean why they light candles? I just said the story about how they lit the candles in the Beit HaMikdash. Says Rabbi Elohi, because the hadlaka was not part of the miracle. It would have been enough to take the oil, to fill up the cups of menorah. It would have been enough. The Bryce is asking, literally asking this question. Why don't we just fill up the menorah with oil and let it be? Don't light it. Why do we have to light the menorah? Just fill it up with oil. The whole miracle was the finding of the oil, not the lighting of the menorah. That's how long you should do it. If it was because of the 8 days that the candle lasted, so that you would do it for 8 days because that's how it lasted. Okay, well, that's the Beis Yosef Kasha that my Zaidi actually helped me write in my Bar Mitzvah speech. He's on here. The question of Beis Shammah and Beis Hillel and the question of the Beis Yosef, why is it 8 days? Shouldn't it be 7 days? Because 7 days is a miracle, because the first day they had enough oil for the first day, and the Beis Yosef has a bunch of different answers. There's a sefer that has 100 answers to this question. So yeah, he talks about that also in the midst of this, but I just didn't bring it. So he says, Al zemet haritain emes, ki ha-hadlaka lo ha-isa min ha-nes, el mishum shachash v'anayim nasla hem ha-nes hedliku ha-neres halal shev kavu ha-yivanim. They just lit it because the Greeks had extinguished the fire. Kain gam anachnu nadlik ha-neres v'naskir ha-yeshua shas ha-shem nachash v'anayim. We should also remember the nes that happened with the Chashmonaim. We should we should put in the effort to do like they did. Lahadlik tamid ner ha'emuna. Interesting phrase. Asher hamaharsim umachrivim bein ela asher mimenu yatsu. O ela mishcheinenu mevachim lechabos. We should sort of light the candle in opposition to those who were trying to destroy us, who were trying to extinguish us. Harei she'ikar mitzvah Chanukah hi hashemen v'lo ha'hadlaka v'hem osim v'hipuch. Right? The whole point of the miracle is to have, the whole point of Chanukah is to have the oil, not the lighting. Right? That's what the Breislik tries to emphasize there. V'hem osim v'hipuch. And they're doing the opposite. They have the lighting without the oil. That's exactly the opposite. Osim ha'hadlaka ikar v'hashem v'hafel. You're making the oil substandard or secondary to the lighting. And that's not the point. That's raya number one. V'yatavi l'cha raya l'zivradis v'migil d'anis v'chafi b'kitziv chanukah tam niyal yoma uch shek shenisu ha'yivan v'lecha timus ha'shkola shvani sh'chavir yas yad v'yisru n'divad k'lo v'asel v'ach shemen ha'shayim munach v'o chosam ha'shol kolon gadol. Oh, this was the braisa. I think these two paragraphs are out of order. V'lo hayo l'o l'alakel yom ha'chav v'nas v'ol nes v'hidik ches yom l'shana ha'charis kabu shmona yom ha'im. Right, so that's the story you hear in day school. They found the oil and it lasts for 8 days, and that's why you have 8 days. And then it says, this is the Brisa, so listen how the Brisa says it. Umar ra'u lasos Chanukah ches yamin. Right, v'halo Chanukah sh'asa Moshe u'shlom alohaya elevaz. The Brisa says, didn't Moshe only keep it for 6 days? The Chanukah, I mean, what's the Chanukah there? The Chakunas HaMizbeach of the Beis HaMikdash. So, Moshe Rabbeinu of the Mishkan, yeah. Okay, good. Seven, but yeah. But the point is that the Brisa asked this question. In following up on the story, right? The story said they lit the candles for 8 days. And then it asks the question, why did they do it for six? What do you mean why did they do it for six? They lit for eight. So they lit for eight, they do for eight. What kind of question is that? Oh, you know why it was 8 days? Because of the Mizbeach thing. V'tikun kli sharis, and because they were figuring out all the different utensils. And then it continued to ask, umar ra'u lahadlik ha'neros. Okay, fine, it's 8 days, but why are you lighting the candles? Why are you lighting the candles? Because they lit the candles. What do you mean? Because they relit the candles, that's why we light candles. So this is Rabbi Elohi. It's a pretty good raya. It's a pretty good proof that the Brisa clearly is entertaining the possibility, first of all, to not do it for 8 days, and then to not even light candles. Right? That the miracle would have been enough just to have oil. That would have been enough to miracle. Okay, and then he asks another question. This gets into something that we probably can't relate to even within the way that we consume natural gas. When we consume our gas, as long as the pipes are open, it'll work. But last week, I was trying to prepare for Shabbos, or not I was, but a family member of mine was trying to prepare for Shabbos. Using the propane gas grill that we had in the backyard. You put the stuff on the thing. We turned it on. It's out of gas. So we have to run to the gas station, get a new propane tank. It's annoying, but that's how it works. It lasted a couple years. So here he says also, back then, the resources weren't as unlimited as we have them today. David Barth tells me that the natural gas that we have today is pumped from Louisiana. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's crazy. He would know. I'm saying, but the point is, that's how much natural gas is being pumped through the entire country through these pipes. We have such an abundance of it. Obviously, the climate, researchers will have to tell us how much we have, whatever. But we have so much of it that is just being pumped from all over the country. So here, he's talking about a very different situation. This is a situation, if it's coal-powered gas, then you're for sure talking about a different situation. You have to have literal coal on hand to burn it at the local power plant and then burn it up. But even natural gas, assuming that the refineries weren't as industrialized as we have today, they couldn't go as deep into the ground. They didn't have the piping system like we have today. So they would run out of natural gas at some times. So that's the second. That's the second point here, which is what he calls his third point. We have to be worried about a destruction which we can't fix. The Gemara himself tells us about when we stop eating chametz. Technically, you have to wait. You have to stop eating chametz when it's the time to bring the Karban Pesach, which the earliest time to do so is midday, chatzos. But we don't stop at chatzos. We stop much earlier. Why? Anyone know why? Anyone remember from Pesachim? L'yom ha'me'unan, for a cloudy day. Maybe we won't be able to tell when it's chatzos. So we stop a couple hours earlier to make sure that we're not going to go past that line. Nowadays, I know we have all the scientists and whatever, we can figure it out, but we still have that minhag, we still have that Issur Derabanan. So here also, Nachush Hacha Gamkein L'milsa Deis Rachish Tuva, something which happens a lot. I don't know how often it happens, but he's saying it happened a lot. K'mo Shekara Pamim Shekol B'nei Ha'ir Lo Yuchlu L'hadlik Es Minoro Sehem. It's happened before that many people are all of a sudden not able to light their houses. They're not able to light their lights. Why? It's dark everywhere. Because of some reason. Maybe the people are bad at their jobs and they can't bring the fumes or they can't burn out the oil or the gas that's coming through. They can't do it. Or there's some kind of water that they would use in order to refine the oil somehow. They would burn it off, or the oil, I think you dissociate, the oil runs off, or the different things would run off as you burn it, something like that. The oil would run off this way and not affect the gas, but maybe the oil would be affected by that water. So for whatever reason, it's going to affect the ambulation of the gas through the pipes. Whatever the reason is, doesn't matter what the reason is. Nimsa hachazen, meaning the person in the shul, was about to light the menorah, right? So you turn the thing, and the gas is coming out of the spigot, whatever, and then all of a sudden he's saying, Hashem, 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 Hazak, Ner, Shal, Hanukkah, Osa, Bracha, Levatala, Vahamitzvah, Batala. You said a bracha unnecessarily, there's no gas, and you're trying to light it here with some kind of wick, and you can't do it. Good. So the difference is what we would call biyado l'tachta. Is it within your purview, within your jurisdiction, within your power to change the situation? Meaning maybe you can't change it, but is it within your ability to change it? When it comes to gas, you have no idea what to do with the power plant. It's not your jurisdiction. You can't go and burn more coal or extract more natural gas from the ground. But if it's a wick and the wax is too wet or whatever, you can figure out how to do it. Maybe you won't be able to, but you could. It's in your power to do something. Okay, I think what he's talking about, maybe that's a good response. I don't know. But what we're talking about here is be able to talk to use this specific method would not be able to work. Right. Right, the Shabbos candles don't work, whatever. Yeah. Yeah, obviously there are statistical analyses to be done here. There are always anomalies that could happen, but if we're talking about 99.9% of the time it works, so then we're not going to.
So then perhaps.
Yeah, Leonard.
By this third reason, maybe this wouldn't apply to me.
Okay, good. Good.
The first two would.
Right. Whatever. The second one was basically the first one.
Right.
But, yeah, James. Yeah, it's a good question. Yeah. We've talked about this, if you remember, I'm sure you do. My first Shabbos Shuvah Drasha, we talked about the different kinds of tekiyos that you blow, right? Different kinds of blows. And why do we blow all those different types? Because maybe this is how you're supposed to blow it, or maybe that's how you're supposed to blow it. And we had said, wait a second, what if you aren't doing the mitzvah properly the first time you do it, and then you have to wait until you do it the second way, right? That first time, Ravi blows. So he blows, you know, three times the truest first, right? The tzkiah, truest, tzkiah? No, tzkiah, shvarim, truest first, right? So you do the shvarim, truest, all the shvarim, truest. How do we know that's the right way to blow? So we're going through all of those for what? For nothing, potentially. And then you get to the second one, which is the tzkiah, shvarim, truest, tzkiah, and then maybe that's not even the one. And maybe the real one is the tzkiah, truest, tzkiah. In which case, you're doing all this stuff before you get to the mitzvah. So how long do you have? So this is what we explained back then. It's not considered a hefsek as long as you're trying to do the mitzvah. That's the barometer, which is why there's a whole discussion as to whether you can say that yihirasan in between. There's yihirasans that you look in your mouth, you have those yihirasans in between the tzakiyos. Because that's not part of the mitzvah, you're just talking. And that, in which case, that could be a hefsek, which is why some people say, I would tell you, to not say those yihirasans unless you have a minute to say them. So then it's not a hefsek. Because all the meanwhile, while you're trying to do the mitzvah, it's not considered a hefsek. I think we quoted someone who said that, similar to like a lulav. If you're trying to shake a lulav, and then you're just not doing it the right way, so then you can continue trying to do it until you get it right. As long as you're involved in the mitzvah, it's the same, you're allowed to. That's the idea. So here also, as long as you're involved in it, so you'd be allowed to. So he's going to make a bracha with V'chi heichi d'chayshin Hashem yipasha af agav gam im yifshar lo tiyeh berchas l'batala harei hizlik v'as ha-mitzvah. Allah kam kam as he's talking about a different case there. The kam and nachshel kilkol hamavili de brachu batal levatal mitzvah gamrei. And he talks about the famous Rashba, which we've talked about before. The Rashba was asked in his one of his tshuvas, why is it that we don't make a bracha on tzedakah? Why don't we make a bracha on tzedakah? Bracha asher kishem tzotav tzvanu al nitzinas tzedakah. And then you give someone a person what? Because maybe they're going to say no, thank you. Right? Maybe they're going to say, no thanks, I don't want it. And then what are you going to do? You just made a bracha levatala. Because it's not biyado l'takin. It's not in your power to make sure that mitzvah is done. So here also, you can't fix it. He goes on to say, I didn't bring it here, but that's what he says. But the most interesting part to me is the last paragraph. This is one big paragraph. There's no break here. I thought it just happened to paste it in two sections. I love this paragraph. I've talked about this in show before. This is conclusion. Ahuvi yididi, my beloved, Nora os neflesi v'nafshi agama alai. I'm distraught. V'me'od, me'od, very distraught. V'shmoa ki nevala kazos nasa bekir b'chem. That this terrible abomination is happening in your midst. Almazos v'almazos. You know, how could this happen, basically? Mare da Avram, which is like a Talmudic form of a curse. You know, how could this happen? You know, master of Abraham. It's not for the sake of Hashem, for the lighting, the illuminating a light that they did this, that they sanctified these people sanctified the menorah. Hashem doesn't need their light, which is sort of a paraphrase what's the phrase in. In the 3 weeks we read it. I don't know. Hashem doesn't need your low rov zivchachem. Lama li rov zivchachem amar Hashem. Why do we need order kamanos? Hashem doesn't need a sheep, right? Hashem doesn't need your turtle dove. But rather, lo orahu mevakesh miyosh vechoshevich tamavis. He doesn't want their light, the people that are sitting in darkness. This is sort of the poetic license of Rabbi Lowy. Aval, why do they like it? Why do the people like it? Because it looks good. It's enticing. which is obviously a quote from Gan Eden, from Adam and Chava. Tava hu leinayim, right? The fruit is beautiful to see. And then he says the following phrase, which is so important. I think today it speaks even more. V'hanetia hara lirdof acharei kol davar chadash atzumahi. That there is an inclination, an evil inclination that we all have to chase after something which is new. And it's a deep inclination we all have. That new and exciting innovation, we all have. Ooh, look at that new shiny thing. Look at that real new innovation. Let's try to use that. You know, when sous vide cooking came out, the shilas abound. Can we use it on Shabbos? Right? Can we use it with milk and meat in the same pot? Oh, sous vide. Oh, now it's like a year later, 2 years later from that fad. Like, no one cares about it anymore. Anyone uses sous vide anymore? I don't know. People have them. Maybe once in a while you'll use it. But like, who cares anymore? What? You don't know what a sous vide is? It's a controlled boiling of the water so that you can do it for a long time, as opposed to putting it on like a cooktop where the temperature gets very hot, whatever. So this, you can keep it at a specific temperature, and you can long cooking of the meat, whatever. You don't even know about it, but it was the biggest thing 3 years ago. Everyone was asking, can we use it because it's sealed in a bag? So can you use basar v'chalav in the same because they're sealed? And can you cook it? Can you use it from before Shabbos? The whole thing. So, that's netia hara lirdof acharei kol davar chadash atzumahi. It's a deep atzumahi bekirbam. It's so deeply embedded in their being. This newfangled thing. Oh, look at this natural gas. It's such a wonderful thing. Let's use it for a mitzvah. They don't really care for the mitzvah. They care for the gas. It's cool. It's a new thing. Ad ki kol tov v'ra yamiru. All good things, they replace them with bad things. V'yashan mifnei chadash yosiyu. And old things, they bring out for they do away with it for the new things. V'al kol davar emes v'nachon yomru katsa nafshinu b'lechem haklokal, which is a paraphrase from what's lechem haklokal. This is a couple weeks ago, we said in the parsha, the Jewish people didn't like the money anymore. We don't want this old bread. We're done with this thing. We've had it for a year already. B'lechem haklokal. Right, so this is part of the human condition. Kiyashan nashan, who is old and is worn out. V'imach maschiseron yidia asu. So maybe you're gonna give them the benefit of the doubt. It's not because they're lusting after the new innovations. It's really because they just don't know any better. V'imach maschiseron yidia asu. It's just because they don't know any better. Kein pshia, it's also pshia. It's also negligent. Lamo shalu l'chacham. You're doing it without asking anybody. Hashem, who would be so fearful of Hashem? Imrak Talmachi, Gil Haraz Beya Vechuskahu, even the most menial, you know, Talmud Chacham, who knows about an egg inside of a dairy dish, which is a phrase from the Gemara, I think, in Chulin, about whether or not that would be considered, you know, milchik. Yisrael Shemuos Lo Tovos Kaila. There are people that could answer that question. Kasher Chadashim Lab Karm Yavau, when something new comes up. Kasher shamanu v'kasher ra'inu, Hashem tzvos ha'tzvachos yagen aleinu yakol acharedim el dvarav. Hashem, who is protecting us, should protect us over all of the ones who are fearful or trembling of His word. So this is Rabbi Yalowi's response to the innovation of gas-powered anything, but to use it for menorah. In the myopic sense. So then he's talking only about menorahs. Then in the general sense, he's talking about innovations generally. And he's talking about the people in America who have come to America, who have benefited from the luxuries of American industry and have seen, look at all these innovations, and he sees down the road that this is going to happen again. Right? Some new innovation is going to come out in America, which later on would be electricity. What? Texaco Chavez, he wasn't necessarily speaking about that, but even in the immediate future, electricity was on the rise. It was only a couple decades past this that literal electricity was sort of throughout the whole world. And he sees that this is an appropriate time to talk about how we view innovation. As they say in that Jurassic Park movie that I got a non-Jew to watch for me, we're asking so much whether we could do it, we never asked whether we should do it, right? Because the innovations are wonderful and they feel like we're accomplishing something and they're very empowering, No pun intended. But in the end of the day, the question is whether we should have them, not whether we could have them. So here Rabbi Lowy sort of sees the writing on the wall. These American Jews are just taking whatever they can get, and therefore he sees worthy of sort of giving this warning before the next thing comes out. A beautiful sort of mussar to us, that sometimes we have to make sure that the reason we're doing things is not because it's new, fancy, and exciting, but because that's the proper thing to do. We do it because Hashem wants us to do it in the way that Hashem wants us to do it. And even though something is new and exciting, we want to bring it into Yiddish, we want to bring it into our mitzvot, we have to still take care that we're doing the mitzvot properly, first and foremost. And then we can bring in the innovations. Yeah, Henry.
No, I was just logging in to thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you, Henry. Shkarach, everyone, for coming. Mirz Hashem, Leah's Neshemesh, Haven Aliyah. Thank you, Milt, for sponsoring for the elevation of her soul. Mirz Hashem, we'll see what we come up with on Labor Day. Okay, Shkarach.
Thank you very much.